This episode of Heritage Radio Network on Tour was recorded at Slow Food Nations 2017, a festival to taste and explore a world of good, clean, and fair food for all. Slow Food Nations took place in Denver over the weekend of July 14th through 16th and included panels, workshops, roundtables, cooking demos, farmers markets, food tastings, and more. Heritage Radio Network's Kat Johnson traveled from Bushwick to the Mile High City to report on this first-of-its-kind international gathering presented by Slow Food USA. Heritage Radio Network on Tour is made possible by the support of the Julia Child Foundation.
Good afternoon. My name is McKenna, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this session. Just a little bit about Slow Food. Slow Food is a nonprofit committed to inspiring individuals and communities to change the world through food that is good, clean, and fair for all. Will you take a minute to make a donation if you feel so inclined? We would be very grateful for your support. If you go to loveslowfood.com this weekend, any amount will make you a Slow Food member. And this session is The Color of Farming, and I will now pass it back over to Angela so she can get you all started today. So thanks again for being here, and thanks to our presenters. So
thank you all for being here. As was mentioned, this is a panel called The Color of Farming. And in a nutshell, what we're talking about is the vestiges of a belief system in white supremacy and capitalism that has created this industrial production system that's left us with social exploitation, social oppression, and environmental degradation. So our work is, how do we live within that belief and practice system and dismantle it and create, as we say, within the slow food movement, a system that is good, clean, and fair for all? So that's our work. I was blessed to have been part of the Food Justice Working Group, who was given the task of trying to ensure that the questions of food justice, food sovereignty, food access, equity, were woven into the fabric of Slow Food Nations. And we've designed a variety of events, activities, including this panel. And part of our work is not to just take the assignment and end our purpose at Slow Food Nations, but to extend our work within the confines of the Slow Food USA organization in the future. So we welcome you all to be a part of that ongoing effort. You know, you can leave us your name, contact, take one of our cards, and because we're going to be having other kinds of meetings and considerations and webinars and who knows what will come out of this, okay? We've also developed, as part of this working group, a food justice resource guide that will be available online on the Facebook page and things like that. And we also encourage other contributions to that resource guide, okay? So here we are within the confines of an hour conversation and discussion, not meant to try to answer every question and deal with every nuance of the last 500 years that we're factoring in. So we have a panel of that we've taken time to really be selective about folk and where they were from, working with. On my left, and we'll all get introduced here ourselves here in a few minutes, Kai Nguyen from Louisiana Veggie Farmers Cooperative, Rudy Arredondo from the Latino Worker Farmers and Ranchers Association, Aretha Bay with the Churro Sheep Presidium, and Angela Harris, former professor of law at UC Davis. And we're going to begin with Angela, and she's going to kind of give us a kind of a historical context. But now be aware, I hope you're all aware, that there are some bad sisters in California, like Kamala Harris, and here's Angela Harris. Kamala's a senator.
I would like to say I'm related to Kamala, but I am not, as far as I know. Thank you all for coming out on this afternoon. We were just talking about how it's kind of the sleepy time of the afternoon, so I really appreciate you being here. First thing I want to say is that my role on the panel really is kind of the kickoff. These folks are the experts, and you're going to hear from them a lot more. I'm just here to kind of give context and repeat some of the historical stuff that you may or may not know. And I'm a law professor. I teach or taught. I just retired at the University of California, Davis. And one of the classes that I regularly taught and probably will continue to teach in the future is food justice. But it's a subject that I've really started learning about just in the last couple of years, my work comes out of critical race theory. So I teach courses about the history of racial discrimination, white supremacy, and its impact on all aspects of American life. And so it's from there that I started getting interested in environmental justice. And over the years, more and more of my EJ students were really interested in food. So I started learning about food justice. So I'm really on a path of learning. And as I say, you got, these guys are the people who truly know, but I'm the professor and we like to talk, so I can talk. So just a little bit about myself to set the stage. So I'm from Southern Ohio, hour out of Cincinnati, a very small town called Yellow Springs. And it's a college town. It's surrounded by farms. But growing up, I was never involved in farming. My family was not a farming family. My parents moved to Yellow Springs because my dad worked for the local Air Force base. And so we went to school with a lot of farmers' kids, a lot of kids who were doing 4-H, Future Farmers of America. There were a lot of soybeans, a lot of hogs, Jersey cattle. There's a lot of farming going on, but I was not part of that world. My dad actually comes from farming people, not large-scale farming, but homestead farming in Virginia. And he tells the story of traveling from Philadelphia, where he grew up, to visit his cousins and relatives on the farm in Virginia. And he remembers one day, I think one of his aunts wringing a chicken's neck and watching the chicken run around with its neck broken, and that's kind of one of his big memories. But my dad also told me another story, which was about his own father, my paternal grandfather. And my grandfather's most vivid memory of Virginia was seeing a black man who had been lynched hanging from a tree. And after seeing that as a young boy, it was my grandfather's aspiration to get out of the country and get out the rural area, get out of Virginia. So he moved to Philadelphia, and it was an urban setting in which my dad grew up. My parents ended up back in farm country when my dad, with his degree in physics, could not get a job in private industry other than a janitorial position. But he got this job at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Southern Ohio. And that's how I came to live in farm country. So fast forwarding a couple years, as I've said, my teaching at the law school is mostly about race. But over the years, I started getting interested in environmental justice and then food justice. And one fact that I came across when I was preparing a lecture for my food justice course really stuck with me. And that was a factoid from USDA that in 2007, 80% of U.S. farmers were white men. And that really kind of took me back, and I started thinking about that. Why would that be the case? How did we get there? Particularly given our history, just thinking of African Americans, our history of being an agricultural people, right? That's the purpose of why we were here in the first place. So that really got me started on this quest to understand more about the color of farming. And towards that end, I've been doing some reading in history and also talking to folks who are contemporary farmers, both rural and urban. And so I want to share just a little bit about what I've learned. And I apologize in advance to those of you who heard Ricardo Salvador's talk, because he really set the big picture stage. And a lot of what I'm going to say kind of just fits in a little bit into his big picture. So the racialization of farming, so the way that race got woven into farming, of course, didn't happen by accident. And the way I talk about it with my students is to talk about Thomas Jefferson, founding father. Right? So on the one hand, Jefferson famously viewed family farming as the life best suited for democracy. He felt that independent small farmers, yeoman farmers, would be free citizens because they were unbought, unbossed, they were independent, they could make their own living. And his love for the idea of family farming gave rise to national legislation like the Homestead Act, which gave ordinary Americans access to cheap land for agriculture. On the other hand, Jefferson himself was not really a family farmer. He had a lot of other things going on and too much going on to run a farm himself. So his own farm followed a very different model, but also a quintessentially American model, and that's the plantation. And as all you know, plantation farming, especially in cotton, combined with northern manufacturing, is what built the incredible wealth of the United States. So how does Thomas Jefferson reconcile these things? On the one hand, he's all about family farming as the way to make this country great as a political entity. On the other hand, in his own life, he's pursuing a very different model of farming that has nothing to do with democracy. Well, he takes the same path that many other founding fathers took, which is he believes that only some people are capable of governing themselves in a democratic way. Right? So as you may know, Jefferson was the one who speculated in his famous essay, Notes on the State of Virginia, that Negroes were inherently inferior to whites physically, mentally, and morally. He liked Indians a lot better than that. He thought they had some capacity to grow. But he didn't have any problem with taking their land and moving them somewhere else. So race, along with gender, becomes the way that our country justifies calling itself a democracy while strictly limiting who can be part of that democracy, we the people. Okay. So the racialization of farming, though, doesn't start with Thomas Jefferson, and it doesn't end with him either. The racialization of farming happens through government policy, federal, state, and local, and it really comes to define both the family farming model and the plantation farming model. So, as I mentioned, the Federal Homestead Act provided individual families with the opportunity to start family farms, giving them access to inexpensive land along what was then the frontier. But where did that land come from? It was taken from Native people, and Native people were moved off the most fertile agricultural lands through a federal policy of treaties, violence, and fraud. And one of the cases, probably one of the first cases that beginning law students read when they first get to law school, is in property class. And we read and talk about a case called Johnson versus McIntosh, which is decided in the early 19th century. And that case explains how only Europeans can own land, right, with full title. Right? Why? Because the official policy of the Europeans who had discovered the New World was that as non-Christian savages, Indians were not capable of developing land properly. They were just going to leave the land a wilderness as opposed to the white settlers who were going to make the land productive. And that's really one of the founding cases of American property law, based on this idea of the doctrine of discovery. Okay. So you can see that people of color are getting locked out of the land ownership system and access to farming even as the nation is getting started. And even after the Civil War, Homestead Act land seldom got to black people. Right? You may know the famous story of 40 acres and a mule, the demand that the freed slaves had after the Civil War. Since we had put so much labor into the land, the idea was that now we should own some of that land, be able to farm it for ourselves. But the former slaves never got those 40 acres that they were promised. And those who were able to purchase land often found themselves later run off the land, again, through a combination of violence, fraud, or just being cheated. More subtle but just as effective has been the slow starvation of Black family farms through depriving them of access to price supports, access to credit, access to new knowledge and technologies. And this was done with the knowing and deliberate collusion of the federal government through USDA. So historians have documented, and it's really interesting, that the greatest period of land loss by Black farmers was not right in the period after the Civil War. It was during the Civil Rights Movement. It was in the 1960s that the greatest velocity of Black land loss happened. And in part, that's because USDA was actively supporting Jim Crow and resisting civil rights. Okay. So there's currently 5 anti-discrimination lawsuits going on against USDA. And Pigford versus Glickman is one of the most famous ones. It was brought on behalf of Black farmers. It settled in 1999 and was one of the largest settlements against an agency of the federal government ever, with about $1 billion paid out to African-American farmers as of 2012. So that's part of our history that we don't often know about. But this was a huge settlement based on the fact that it was clear that for decades and decades, USDA, again, had colluded to deprive Black farmers of access to credit and access to technical knowledge. In addition, there's another case against USDA, Keep Siegel versus Veneman, on behalf of Native American farmers, with a settlement that was approved in 2011. There's a case called Garcia versus Johans on behalf of Latino farmers, still ongoing, with USDA developing an administrative claims process, which has had a lot of problems. And by the way, there's also a case called Love versus Johans on behalf of women farmers. Again, all based on this involvement of USDA. So that's how family farming then, really the history of family farming is really also a history of racial exclusion and exploitation. Meanwhile, the plantation system, as we know, built obviously on unpaid labor, on land taken from other people, didn't go away after the Civil War, right? It just transformed. And one of the things that stayed the same, however, was the idea of race. So one of the things that we see happening after slavery ends is we see the emergence of the sharecropping system, which kept poor folks in the South, both Black and white, in grinding poverty for decades, while benefiting a small group of elite farmers who used their economic power to control political power in the South. So when the New Deal arrives, for example, it brings in a new system of price supports, low-cost loan programs, and technical support for commodity farming, which is kind of the origin of what we now call the Farm Bill. But who benefited from that system? Primarily the inheritors of the plantation elite. Meanwhile, agricultural workers were cut out of New Deal protections like the Fair Labor Standards Act because the plantation elite wanted to keep their cheap labor force intact. And when the South finally does mechanize, it's disproportionately Black farm labor that gets displaced. Another way that the plantation system gets transformed is in the West, which comes to rely on immigrant labor. So in my home state, California, the plantation system relied on various waves of immigrants from India, from China, from Japan, eventually Mexico and Central America. Each group initially gets praised for being hardworking and then is prevented from climbing the ladder from farm work into farm ownership. Again, often in openly racialized terms. Today tends to be more about the question of whether you're undocumented or not. And the absence of legal papers is what keeps farm laborers overwhelmingly disempowered in terms of being able to fight for their rights. And then a third way that the plantation has survived is that it swallowed the family farm. So independent small farmers today everywhere are suffering economically from the concentrated market power of global corporations. all farmers of all colors are now under the thumb of this transform plantation system, right? And many of you may know the statistics about the huge levels of concentration, corporate concentration of ownership in things like processing. And then the last thing I want to say about this history is that it's really a global history. And in some ways, it goes back to European colonialism. So it's not just the United States that adopted this doctrine of discovery that I told you about. The doctrine of discovery was part of international law. Indigenous people were dispossessed of their land in the Caribbean, in Canada, in Brazil, in Australia, and in New Zealand under exactly the same notion, right? And it's not just the U.S. that used racial theories to justify plantation systems. England, France, Portugal, and Spain all used theories of racial inferiority to justify plantation systems, even in countries where now whites are the minority. So in the process, we got a food system that helps produce and sustain race and class inequalities. And it's a system that now uses international trade law, domestic immigration law, and intellectual property law to preserve those inequalities between the global South and the global North. So what do we do? So this planet needs a new food system. We need a system that doesn't exploit people. We need a food system that doesn't exploit resources. And how do we build it? Folks on the panel are going to talk about their perspectives on this. What I tell my law students is that taking on a project as big as this means that we have to follow that old advice to think globally and act locally. So on kind of the global front, there's an organization called La Via Campesina, which is an international organization fighting for a new international legal agreement to protect small farmers around the world from being displaced. In the U.S., we don't have any kind of basic charter for access to food, access to land, access to farming, right? But there are things that we can do, and again, thinking about what law students can do at the kind of macro level to make that path a little bit easier. For example, my state of California recognizes the right to water now as a human right. So one of the things that I encourage my students to think about and to fight for is how do we develop these big principles, kind of rights-based principles, to help people have some measure of food sovereignty and security. On the local level, there's tons of things that lawyers can do. So again, we need litigators to continue anti-discrimination suits, to challenge ag-gag laws, enforce environmental regulations. But we also need lawyers who don't maybe want to go to court, but know a lot about how to write a contract or how to read a contract. Lawyers who understand how to build a cooperative as opposed to the for-profit corporate form. We need lawyers who can work with municipal and regional planners to design institutions that connect rural farmers with urban consumers and that allow urban gardens and farms to exist without destroying quality of life in the neighborhood. We need lawyers who can create community land trusts, negotiate contracts, and invent new legal structures that nobody's seen for preserving community control over land and water. We need lawyers who can understand how to structure deals for access to credit, like direct public offerings to support farming and food-related businesses. But the biggest thing that I tell my students is that transforming the food system is badly needed racial justice work. Sometimes people want to put race to the side and say, well, it's really all about class, it's about economics. There was a moment before our current administration when people like to say we were all post-racial now, we got past all that race stuff. But the American history of farming shows how race and economic exploitation have been tied together since the beginning. And the fight for economic justice is also a fight for racial justice. We're trying to uproot a system of exploitation at every level, and that means communities of color at the front lines of the struggle, whether it's about organizing farm workers, trying to prevent further black land loss, protecting tribal sovereignty so the First Nations can govern and steward their own resources, or putting more grocery stores into food deserts. And it's also about not just institutions and regulations to change the way that we grow and distribute food, or even it's not just about obesity and public health. I've been interviewing several young folks, especially urban ag folks in the Bay Area, Black and Latino, who are doing urban agriculture against their parents' wishes. Their families say, you know, we didn't put you into college for you to go and be a farmer, right? We didn't raise you to go pick some fruit. But for a lot of the young folks that I'm interviewing, urban ag is about recovering farming traditions outside the conventional system, whether it's biodynamics or what they now call permaculture, the fancy word, but is part of a lot of folk traditions that folks remember their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers telling them about. So growing food is also about coming to terms with and healing the plantation past. And that's a national conversation, a national project that we all badly need. In addition, reviving traditional knowledge and cultural practices can help build a regenerative future for all of us. So people of color really need to be part of the forefront of this struggle as we try to build a new farm system. And again, food justice is racial justice. Thanks.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you. 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 Wonderful. She has a document in the Law Review Journal called The Color of Farming. Look it up. It's about 44 pages. The nation summarized. But it's a document that we should all have in our backpack. Okay? It covers this whole sense of the last centuries. So thank you so much. So today we have a panel of three other individuals who are practitioners of what Angela has talked about. I want to say quickly that we had a fourth panel member named Matthew Rayford, who's a chef, farmer in Georgia, that flew in here. I think it was yesterday, had a family emergency, and had to fly right back. So we just want to send him, you know, good vibrations, good love for him being here and taking care of some family business. Now, so on my right, I have Aretta Begay. And we've asked all the panel to kind of address a couple of questions before we open it up to those who are here, okay, and talk a little bit about the role of collaboration, partnerships, and what you're doing to address these kinds of historical and current structural racism confinements, okay? Questions of collaboration, partnership. And then we're going to pose another question that talks more about where are you headed in the future? 5 years from now, what will you be doing? What do you want to be doing? Okay? And then we'll entertain some questions from you all of the panel. All righty? So, Aretta. And she's with, again, with the Churro Sheep Presidium.
Hello, everyone. My name is Aretta Begay. I'm from the Navajo Nation. I work and operate on the tribal reservation, and I grew up there, and I grew up on a ranch, so I'm very familiar with animals, and we have, we work with a lot of ranchers, so we have a similar scope of work as do farmers and co-ops and so forth. We have, we share the similar local indigenous knowledge and land stewardship. In our case, it's animal husbandry and everything. It all is connected. So in our organization, or in our Presidia, we were established in 2006 officially under Slow Meat. And our Navajo Churro sheep breed was inducted into the Ark of Taste. And it's a rare breed. It is it was endangered, but it's now making it to the threatened level. And it was a sheep breed that was, I guess, in an abundance before one of our historical trauma events that we had, known as the Long Walk, where we had to travel on foot for several hundred miles into the state of New Mexico, and we lived there for a few years before we were able to return back to our homeland. So unfortunately, during that process, we lost the sheep, and the government removed and took all of our the sheep that we had raised and bred for the desert environment, specifically for that environment. And when we returned, it was replaced with other commercial breeds. And at the time, they believed, well, they noticed that we were eating the sheep for the, you know, for the meat. And so they said, well, there's commercial breeds that are better in meat. So maybe you guys should just, you know, try this commercial breed. So that's how we lost the abundance of the sheep breed. And so it became rare in the 1970s. I believe there was a documented count of roughly 800 on the Navajo reservation, and it became very rare. So there was an animal scientist with the Utah State University who helped us started the Navajo Sheep Project, and he literally went all across the Navajo Nation, and he started documenting, just driving down the road and looking at almost every sheep corral and finding the characteristics of the specific sheep that were still that may still be around. So he got some sheep producers that still had these flocks in purebred form. So he got them to breed more so that they can also create starter flocks so that other local Navajo families could restart this breed. And so our Presidium started kind of based off of that last project that they had under the Navajo Sheep Project. So there was another nonprofit organization that was founded in 1990 or 1991 called the Navajo Lifeway, which I'm the current director for. And we provide education around the Navajo Churro sheep breed. And we try to do a lot of educational and workshop centered around the wool and the textile part of the sheep, because the sheep is both our clothing and it's also our meat. So we still to this day continue to practice those, food and textile art. So what we do is we established a Sheep is Life Festival every year in June. We kind of bring everybody, whoever is interested in the sheep breed and in the textile art, we bring them all together, whether you're a goat breeder or a commercial sheep breeder, any breed, we bring them to this festival and we, you know, just have a good old time and have people experience kind of like an informal, kind of like a sheep camp setting, but in a Navajo perspective. So every year we do that in June. So we just had that last month, and we'll have it again next year in June. So you guys can find us on our website, www.navajolifeway.org. And that's where you guys can keep up with some of our latest events. But anyway, in the history of the organization, Navajo Lifeway then became sort of the forefront for Navajo Churro advocacy. So that's where the Navajo Churro Land Presidium eventually came to play and started establishing a meat market for it. So we were able to partner with a few other nonprofit entities and other entities. The American Livestock Conservancy helped us, build awareness around it. The Slow Food Network, the Slow Meat Organization, helped us put the Navajo Churro sheep onto their Ark of Taste, and with the Slow Food Biodiversity Department. So that's a little history behind our Navajo Churro Land Presidium. And to this day, we still continue to practice the traditional butchering styles, nothing related to the USDA butchering style, which we know a lot of the, if you serve to restaurants or you cater to other places, it is kind of like a mandatory thing to do. So we don't have, our tribe doesn't have a USDA slaughtering facility or an official USDA certified kitchen or anything. So a lot of times when we provide workshops, they're either coming out of the someone's private home, or we have it at a local chapter, kind of like a local government establishment place. And we actually provide a lot of traditional demonstrations around the food. We do a lot of plant walks, and we do a lot of wild edible cooking demos, and we cook it with the Churro sheep. So we provide a lot of education centered around that. So we continue to do that to this day.
Thank you. Thank you. Loretta, thank you. Thank you. Okay, next on my left here is Rudy Arredondo, who is again with the Latino Ranchers and Farmers Association.
Thank you, everyone, for coming and for supporting the work that we all do. My name is Rudy Arredondo. I come out of the United Farm Workers Union, organizing farm workers in South Texas when I was a teenager. Worked with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and Gilbert Padilla. Worked on a lot of the initiatives, including the only agricultural labor relations board in the entire United States, which is in California. So that is the core group of our organization, which is the National Latino Farmers and Ranchers, which I had the privilege of founding and to finance its operations. I don't take a salary, I'm a volunteer, and all the money that in partnerships that we have goes to the field where it's needed. We work very, very closely on the Farm Bill. Prior to 2002, the Latino farmers and ranchers had no presence whatsoever. We are on the board of the Rural Coalition, which are our mothership and who help to facilitate the inclusion of our voice into the deliberations and policy, and in terms of helping to for us to organize those clusters of farmers that were interested in hearing their voice in terms of policy, food and agriculture policy development. And that's what we work on. I also had the privilege of working during the Carter administration and Farmers Home Administration. So I was a civil rights officer and also came back during the Clinton administration and worked on civil rights as well, and very familiar. And I kind of hate to disagree with my colleague Angela in terms of attorneys. I have very little. I'm not a big fan of attorneys because they have a tendency to take issues such as the Pickford case, the Garcia case, and then making it their own and carrying out strategy that oftentimes is not helpful in bringing negotiations to the table where the farmer, him or herself, are able to put out the possibilities. So organizing at the local level is where it is that we work. And we were instrumental in getting 36 sections of the 2008 Farm Bill, okay, for small producers and historically discriminated farmers and ranchers. We have had also the privilege of having extremely good partnerships, which includes the Rural Coalition, which is, like I said, our mothership. It is the only multi-ethnic, grassroots, community-based organization that deals with the diversity of the farm and ranching communities. We have, like I said, there's 36 sections, but we also were instrumental in getting legislation to incorporate civil rights, as Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Department of Agriculture. Also, the Office of Outreach and Advocacy was one of our, one of our wins in getting this. And of course, we are at this time extremely involved in the formulation of a farm policy that is directed towards the small producer rather than big agriculture. And, you know, we've had great hopes the past 8 years to have been able to establish some better treatment and access to resources to the small producer, but it never happened. And the consequences of the neglect in rural America is the political environment we find ourselves in. Secretary Vilsack was very much into big agriculture, and I believe that there wasn't a lot of respect for those of us, even though we as small producers of all varieties produce 22% of foodstuff. Okay. So that we have a relationship with the University of the District of Columbia, and we have now 7 years straight a farmer's market. We developed, 2 years ago, we developed a collaborated and formed an urban market in one of the food deserts. Community gardens, aquaponics, hothouse, and in Michigan, for those of you from Michigan, we have a cooperative in Battle Creek called Farmers on the Move, and Michigan State University Extension is one of the partners that we work with Filiberto Villagomez, that I think he is now working towards. He's got, like, statewide opportunities to do some work with us. And we are working on climate change. And the thing that is important for all of us, you know, we are not only the stewards of the land, but we are the first responders to climate events 24/7.
That's right.
Okay? You said this is our asset, whatever, you know, even those folks that are denial about climate impacting us. You know, the floods, the droughts, the failure or the lack of managing the forest, which are the lungs of the land, and those wildfires. We are extremely concerned about the loss of those forests and what that represent. And one of the things that we are working at the present, and I know that there's a Puerto Rican contingent, you import like 80% of your food stuff. We want to change that. So we are at this point looking in terms of how it is that we're going to collaborate with some of you folks from Puerto Rico to establish a sustainable food system in that island. It's long overdue. And with that.
Beautiful. Well, you know, it's so important for elders to describe their work, their legacy, and then our work is to pass it on to the young people. So with that in mind, we pass this baton over to our dear friend, Kai Nguyen from Louisiana.
I'm not that young, but thank you. So I just want to give a little history. I work with a farmers cooperative in New Orleans, Vietnamese farmers cooperative called Veggie. I just want to give a little bit of history of the Vietnamese community in New Orleans. Right after the Vietnam War ended in 1975, a lot of Vietnamese refugees came to America and were kind of like, they're in refugee camps, most of them throughout the country, but one of the closest one to Louisiana was in Arkansas. And the Archdiocese of New Orleans invited several communities, a bunch of members, community members down to New Orleans to kind of resettle in the new country, basically. And so these community members that came down, most of them had known each other for a long time because they had evacuated together 20 years before that from North Vietnam, and when they moved to South Vietnam, they were all involved in farming, fishing. And so when those communities came to New Orleans, it was the climate and the proximity to the Gulf of Mexico was made it easier for them to kind of settle in. And basically, as soon as they came to New Orleans, people started farming, people started going fishing. The community members organized their own farmers market a few years after coming to New Orleans. So the place that they settled was actually, it's urban, it's in New Orleans, but it's kind of on the outskirts of the city. And so when it kind of like, you know, city government would turn a blind eye to things that happened out there, and which was fine, you know, for us out there too. It was a pretty insular community, which worked well for a little while. People were farming, people were squatting on land that wasn't being used to grow food. But then when Hurricane Katrina happened, there was damage in the area and folks had to evacuate. But what happened in that community, in the Vietnamese community out there, was they were actually one of the first community to come back to New Orleans in large numbers. However, this, because of the proximity to where it was, where the community was, the city didn't really understand that or knew that, didn't know that. And when they were redeveloping the plan to rebuild the city, basically that whole area was slated to become green space. And so for the first time, so a lot of community leaders got together, and for the first time we had folks basically, you know, well, I shouldn't say this, older folks that never left the community went and picketing City Hall, showing, you know, people that we were back. I kind of skipped a part, but the main reason we were picketing City Hall, not only did the city not take into consideration that our community had come back, but the mayor at the time, he had made an executive decision to place the landfill that had all the debris from Katrina about like a mile away from our community. So, for our community, that was an environmental justice issue, but a lot is connected to farming also, because a lot of there are a lot of canals that come into our community, and a lot of the community members use those canals to irrigate some of the farms that they were using. So, and that landfill was in proximity with the waterways heading into the community, and so we definitely had to organize community members together. Like I said, folks became civically engaged for the first time since they came to America. Basically, we started getting people registered to vote, showing people, hey, this is a community that, you know, if we can rally a lot of community members together to, like, you know, voice our own opinion and, like, show our political will, basically. We were able to get the landfill shut down, and things were going okay for a few years, and then the BP oil spill happened, and a lot of our community members, as I mentioned earlier, got into fishing as soon as they moved down to Louisiana. And so they'd been in, you know, some of them, their whole like experience in America was as a fisherman, you know. So basically overnight with the oil spill, their livelihoods were basically lost. And so that was a huge, had a huge impact on our community. And so with Katrina and with the oil spill, our organization, we kind of saw an opportunity to kind of like take the knowledge and take the passion that our community had for farming to form a Veggie Farmers Cooperative, which is a group of farmers together. We help them find land, help them build up farms, help them sell their produce to markets to earn income, to kind of like have supplemental income for themselves. And so we started this in 2011. So it's a year after the BP oil spill. And so when we first started, we had a lot of folks that were in the fishing industry. So, you know, they were kind of supplementing their income that was lost because of the oil spill. Nowadays, most of those folks have gone back to fishing full time, which is in a sense good, because they can sustain themselves by then. But we still do have community members in the Farmers Cooperative. We are hoping to expand. Right now, we only have about an acre, pretty small. We're hoping to expand to about 3 or 4 acres within the next year, and to have more and more community members involved. And to your question about collaboration, we tried to work with most of our farmers are retirees or above 55, but we've worked with youth organizations to kind of teach them about food justice, give them plots on our farm to to experiment on their own. And hopefully, you know, we can have that intergenerational knowledge exchange going forward, too.
Okay, very good. Very good, very good. Now, I just want to make a little thought. We had a session yesterday that was called Aligning the Good Food Movement and the Food Justice Movement. I've been involved in food justice work for about 40 years, and we have always loved good food, okay? We've always loved delicious food, healthy food, and made it a part of our work. So in that sense, those of us who are doing work around food justice, we're already have embraced the good food movement. So I think it's more of a question of whether those who are involved in primarily the good food movement are ready to embrace, extend themselves to be a part of this most important movement on the globe, I think. This whole argument in D.C. about the health care bill is really about food and ag. Why are our costs so expensive? Because we subsidize what is unhealthy. So I'm going to pass it on. So it's one of the most important question on the globe today. It's around food and ag. So part of our effort today at the panel and this first question about collaboration, partnerships, networks, was to encourage all of us as we go back home and continue our work, that we will commit ourselves, dedicate ourselves to be more collaborative, to network more, especially with those organizations, those law professors, entities that are working in and around the food justice kind of questions, okay? But collaboration, networking, partnerships, it's how the earth operates anyway. That's how agriculture is possible. So we're just saying as humans that we're trying to catch up with, get in alignment with how the earth works. We think we're separate from the mother. So, but be in alignment. Be about partnerships, collaboration. Now, I'm going to ask the panel to spend about maybe 2 minutes just throwing out their work in the future, where they want to be, say, in 5 years. And once we do that, then we're going to open up with some questions from you all. Is that okay? Okay. So we're going to begin back with Angela. Even though she's retired, she has already a plan.
Well, one of the things that I hope to be doing in 5 years is this fall, my law school is setting up the first water justice clinic, we believe, in the United States. And it's primarily geared towards helping disadvantaged communities across California, but especially in the Central Valley, which is the agricultural section of California, who lack access to clean water. A lot of the toxins are from agricultural runoff. A lot of the communities are farm worker communities, and they're overwhelmingly communities of color. So we were fortunate enough to get money from the state of California to fund this clinic. And one of the things that I want to do now that we have an attorney and law students working on this project is to build it out so that we can be a full service law center for farm worker communities and for small farmers. So my vision is not just about water and access to water resources, but also access to land, pesticide drift issues, and at some point help with farming as well from a progressive perspective. It's a little bit dicey at University of California, Davis, because we are a big ag school and big ag. So the progressive stuff has to kind of hover in the corner and hope that the big boys don't pay too much attention to us, but that's my vision.
Okay, so for the next 5 years with the Navajo Trail Land Presidium, we hope to see a bigger market, at least expand on the all over the Navajo Nation, and hopefully we do have at least no more than a dozen small grocery stores or convenience stores that do sell some sort of meat. So we have within our group some discussions that maybe we could possibly try to get our meat into the stores or in some way form some packaging, creative packages for that type of market. So the other interesting part about it is because both our scope of work not only focuses on the meat, it also focuses on the wool. Our cultural heritage is centered around textile art. Navajo rugs are kind of one of the big antiquity out there. So some of the earlier rugs that were woven before you know, I mean, this goes back like over 500 years, and we've always woven our rugs with Navajo turtle wool. So we'd like to see at some point to sell the meat and the wool together as kind of like a package. You never know, there could be knitters and crocheters or weavers out there that could also eat lamb meat while they're knitting, you know. So we want to create something creative that way, because a lot of our scope of work is always combining both of them. And in our culture, and most indigenous cultures I'm sure are similar, we don't waste anything. Everything we utilize on that animal is used, whether the horns or the hooves or whatever, we eat or use them as tools. And we even eat the bone marrows. We make blood sausage. So there's a lot of things that are associated with the animal. And there, of course, there's stories and creation stories behind that. There are prayers and songs that are associated with the whole entire process of raising the animal to when you're slaughtering it. We do have a sort of a blessing before you slaughter the animal. We provide those teachings within our organization. So we continue to teach that. So we'd love to see that. And for us, language is also a key component to our cultural survival. And so we need to continue teaching the youth and bringing in more younger generation to interact with the elders to continue learning the language, because everything we know, our entire ancestral knowledge and our food knowledge, our land, the knowledge about land and everything and life in general is all embedded in our language. So it is very important for us to sustain that. So we'd love to see that continue. And we would love to continue working with other chefs, indigenous chefs. We do on occasion collaborate with a few. And they usually help us promote the churro meat on, you know, when we do small little tasting events or workshops. So in the future, we'd like to see the continuation of that. And we also want to, we're trying to start our own Navajo Churro registry for Navajo producers only. There is an association called the Navajo Churro Sheep Association, but it's run by non-Navajos, and the perspective from their association is it's almost straying from our heritage, from our culture. And with our own history and with the sheep's history, there are four different breeds of the churro that are true to the original breeds that we've had. So we're trying to raise awareness and trying to create our own label and establishing that. We've just collaborated with one of the registrars with the association, the official association, and she's allowing us to create a label and a name and labeling it in our own language, the Bay. So it's basically in our language, it's called the sheep. And that's just, you know, that's the name we have for the sheep. So we want to put that label onto our meat and or for the churro producers so that when they register it, that, you know, they can have proof that this is an authentic sheep. So we want to create our own within our little grassroots organization to keep that registry or start that registry and sustain that as well and get more breeders to breed that. This year alone, we registered at least close to 500. Last year, there was only one Navajo producer registered under the Navajo Churro Sheep Association. Mm-hmm. And the rest were churro producers that were off the reservation everywhere from Maine to California. And they're not in our culture, from our tribal perspective, they're not true. I mean, they are coming from the churro producers, but they're not living on the same land or eating the same medicinal herbs and wild edible plants that it's native from the desert Southwest. So we'd like to see that continuation. Thank you.
Rudy.
Well, you know, the organization that organization Latino Farmers Association, we have about 95,000 members nationwide. But in addition to that, we collaborate with we're members of RCAF, which is the Independent Beef Producers. We work very closely with Bill Bullard and also with the Sheep Producers, which is a National Family Farm Alliance that Pat O'Toole is the chair of, and they have something like 90,000. So we work in collaboration with that. And, you know, just in terms of our being here, we are looking to put together a legislative package that is a Marshall Plan for rural America. You know, I think that this is an opportune moment to do it, and we would appreciate the support because we're writing this package as we speak, and it is important for us to ensure that those small producers, you know, we are not Cargill, we're not Tyson's, we are not in that league, nor do we want to be, because one of the things that I detest is the monetization of food, and that's what's been happening all along. And that is important for us to remain conscious, because that concentration is not about feeding anybody. It's about profiteering from starvation, situation. And that's not how it is that we are going to function. Food is a lifeline. We want to ensure that our water remains cleaned and that it is it's a public resource that is not there for privatization. We were working against fracking. We stand with Standing Rock. We were privileged to be a part of that. We work with the tribes. We work with the Hmong farmers. We have a fairly good unit up in Fresno, California, both Latino and Hmong farmers, also in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And we help them with advocate, because a lot of the issues have to do with cultural lack of knowledge in terms of how to navigate in capitalist United States of America, you know, where the moral standards have taken a dive. You know, they've been abandoned. We got to reclaim that moral space, because that's what we need to do as human beings in terms of helping one another. So I'm talking to some of the slow food folks in terms of collaboration. Please come to our events. I mean, we come to yours. We have this is, I think, our third or fourth time. And we would love to see you. We are going to be having one right here September 14th through the 16th, Irene Villar, who has the Latino Eco Festival, is having a 4-day in which we have a multifaceted approach to environmental land grabs, finding, and this is an international event as well, and we're co-sponsoring that. So I appreciate if, you know, the Slow Food would have a robust presence there. And in December, the Rural Coalition and the National Latino Farmers and Ranchers are going to be having our gala event at the National Press Club. We're members of the National Press Club. I used to be a journalist, but I prefer my advocacy on behalf of agriculture and farmers and ranchers. It's my chosen. I not that I dislike the journalist piece, but I prefer my hands getting my hands, dirty and looking at how we can make a fair and just system from the fields to the table. So that's our vision.
So for us, right now, this summer, we're in the middle of trying to find financing to acquire a new land for farm expansion to get more community members involved in our cooperative. And the expansion would also include a commercial kitchen because we do have community members that make we have a lady in our cooperative that makes tofu, and we sell it to restaurants and things like that. Now we might be able to do it legitimately to supermarkets and stuff. And then we have other folks that in the community that make a lot of cultural Vietnamese dishes that you'd never really see in restaurants, but they're amazing food. So that's hopefully we had to figure out that out by this summer. But if we do, then, within the next 5 years, we would have that new development, that new farm up. And also we would be building it right next to a health clinic that the nonprofit organization that started the cooperative also runs. And so we would be doing kind of like healthy eating programs with clients of the clinic. In the Vietnamese community, there's a lot of incidences of diabetes. So figuring out programs, ways to like kind of promote healthy eating programs with the farm and the clinic as well. And I want to talk about what Rudy was saying earlier about the farmers and other folks being like at the forefront, feeling the effects of climate change. So in Louisiana, we're also dealing with a lot of coastal erosion. It's probably the area that's most at risk in the world actually right now with land loss. And so because a lot of our Vietnamese community members are involved in the fishing industry, they're going to be heavily affected by coastal erosion and also like the coastal restoration projects that the state has kind of planned for. And so our organization is going to be working to try to get our Vietnamese folks as prepared for that as possible. So that's what we're working on.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All righty. How about that? Wow. So who would like to ask a question, make a comment relative to what you've heard today, questions, thoughts? As you're working on the question, let me do a quick look back. We talked about what's the vision. Yes, ma'am.
I assume some of you are working, still trying to work with USDA or something like that. But
just come to the mic. Speak loud.
How is the current situation in Washington affecting your work? I mean, what are you up against right now?
There is at this time, there's all types of confusion. We're dealing with a 2% across the board budget cut because the Secretary Perdue came in after the budget had been submitted to the Congress, so that he had basically no input with regard to the formulation of that policy of it, that budget.
Would it have been bad, or would it have been worse if he did?
No idea, and no idea because everybody is in paralysis mode in Washington D.C. because of the fact that they don't know how the administration is going to react from one minute to the next. So to us, it is what it is. but because we have to dedicate our efforts on the ground. You can't build any kind of thing from the top down. We are a grassroots organization, and as such, our job is to strengthen our membership in terms of what it is that they need, so then we can translate it into legislative language and incorporate it in terms of what it is going to be our marker bill that we will submit to both in the House and the Senate. And we already spoken with people who are willing to sponsor, and we work across the board. You know, we just had also the privilege of being a part of the Agri Women fly-in that was done 2.5 weeks ago. You know, this is their first fly-in, and it was wonderful to see that these women farmers had their act together and their ability to bring the policymakers to their meeting, okay? Which we have had like a mixed success. Mostly they don't show up. So the things are right now in flux. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But we can, you know, we have to move on forward and put our priorities and our wishes in terms of that marker bill that for small producers.
Yes, go ahead. Yeah, just quickly, like, so we were working with the USDA to talk about a specific grant that had been available every year before this, but the USDA program officers like feel like we would be perfect for this. It's a value-added product grant, but maybe because of the new administration, that grant's not being released yet, where in the last few years it has been available, like in the spring or something. So,
great. Okay. Raise your hand, folks. Okay. Yes, right here.
What have you guys found to be the most effective community outreach within the really undeserved and underrepresented populations? How do you empower them to reclaim their culture?
First, people have to understand where it is that they are. One of our most difficult is to inform folks in terms of what it is that they don't know. They don't know what they don't know. Empowerment is a means in terms of your knowledge base. And that's what we've had to do because a lot of our farmers were not knowledgeable that there's farm programs, there's, you know, for conservation, for operating loans, for facilities at the community level, you know, infrastructure, those kinds of things. So you have to bring them up to par, and you go from there. But it's up to the community to do an inventory of their respective community to ensure that they're going to address and make a plan for those needs that they have at their community. We're facilitators. We facilitate and we provide knowledge and information and technical assistance as needed. So I don't know whether that addresses your question, but that's how we operate.
How do you want to discuss it?
So for our organization, I wouldn't say it was easy to outreach or organize, but we needed them to already have that commitment or passion for agriculture. I'm not a farmer myself. I didn't teach them anything, you know. So if we didn't have them already interested in the kind of like farming aspects of it, it wouldn't have worked. But for us, like, what we wanted to do was, this goes back to Katrina. We really wanted to have like a community led redevelopment plan. So what we did was, whatever we focused our efforts on, it was what the community wanted, And so we did like focus groups and things like that. Like how do people want to go forward? How do people want to redevelop? And so like they're the ones that start with the, hey, we want to do an urban farming project. We wanted to do a community farm. And so from there, we just went to see on our end, like how can we make that happen?
Okay, so. Great. I'm going to have Catherine add some of this from Detroit.
Jim talked about inviting people to be allies with all of us and in the movement. And sometimes that's very difficult for people who aren't a part of people of color and communities to figure out how to do in a respectful way, but in a powerful way. So I would like to ask any of the panel to comment on how do people who are not a part of your community and a part of your history and your experience become allies with you in a strong but respectful way?
But I kind of move beyond this question of us versus them, okay? And I try to work because the work is exciting, it's joyful, but it's about a holistic approach to our communities. It's about this integrated systems approach, and it's about approaching people and not saying, well, because you're this or that, then I can't relate to you and talk to you and welcome you in to what we're doing. So after so many years, that's what works for me, is to reach in every sector, federal, state government, local government, county government, you know, men, women, folks of every ethnicity, in the jails, in the prisons, because all the work is there. So, yes, please, yes.
I wanted to say a little bit about that, too, because it really raises a question that is central to teaching in a law school, because I'm often teaching people who have layers of academic privilege, layers of financial privilege, and often ethnic privilege that don't map up with the communities that they want to serve. And so that's a big question, like, how do I serve? How do I use my knowledge in a way that's going to be helpful to people rather than become solidify the reputation that Rudy mentioned of lawyers who come in and they want to run everything and they think they know better than everybody else and they just take it over. And that it's a fair criticism because that's what happens. So for us, I think, and I'm thinking about the Water Justice Clinic in particular, we also have to train our young lawyers in community lawyering, which is about paying attention to what the community wants. So they talked about the inventory. You can do mappings of communities. But it's basically about going in and being humble and saying, you all are the experts on what has happened to you, what your history is, and what you need. We are not the experts. We're there to help facilitate what you want, and we're here to listen. And if people go in with that attitude of humility and respect, I think it really starts off the collaboration in a strong way, as opposed to coming in and saying, well, I know everything, and now I'm going to teach you how to do this and that, how to garden, how to eat, et cetera, et cetera. So,
you know, one of our most successful collaborations has been with the University of the District of Columbia's College of Agriculture. The collaboration in terms of the development and the support of our farmers market, 7 years now, the putting together that urban farm in that food desert. We also are working towards developing a career track where we bring in young people from the hinterlands to come and learn about agriculture. We've already joined urban and rural. The University of the District of Columbia is the only land-grant college that is dedicated to urban agriculture. And that's really, really important to us because urban folks have a tremendous amount of political juice that rural communities do not have. You know, that the situation in rural America is in dire need of having some what you they used to have. They used to pretty much dictate what urban or agriculture policy was to be. Not anymore, because the representatives, elected representatives, gravitate to where they have all the amenities, broadband access, office space, you know, all of this. And the rural folks have to travel to have a sit down with their elected officials at least an hour, 2 hours. And as those of you who are farming know, we can't afford. If the weather is good, we got to take care of our crops. We got to take care of our animals. It's a 24/7, you know, there's no vacation from agriculture. You know, we have to take care of our livelihood. And so those collaborations with university, we also have a practicum that we're looking in terms of some scholarly writings from the universities. That validates our situation. All those PhDs we want to make sure that they just don't sit on a shelf. We want to have input. Okay, you're going to write about us in terms of rural America. You need to consult with us because we are the experts. We're the ones that have to live that kind of a lifestyle. So don't come in and I'm not your zoo. Okay. So you come, you know what my father used to said, if your friends come in, they're going to work with you. So they didn't come because they knew they would come in to visit and take my time. You know, my time had to be dedicated to the chores and that are a part of living in a rural community. And that's fine. That's good.
I want to add to Rudy because we're the same way. I mean, we work with a land grant office at a local college nearby where we're at, and we also do a lot of food sovereignty events, and that's where we engage with a lot of other non-Navajo community members, or either they're coming in from outside the reservation, coming in to experience our culture or hear about our foods, hearing about everything, our food culture, our pastoral way of life and everything. So usually we encounter a lot of these folks at our food sovereignty events, workshops, and we have our Sheep is Life Festival, which we open it up to everyone, even all the way to the international global level. So we bring in other pastoralists from other cultures who share similar life ways with us, and to also try to engage and make sure that everybody understands that pastoralism is a global thing. It's not just our culture, but there's other cultures we share that with. So, and then, you know, like you said, elders, we bring in a lot of elders. You know, we don't work with a lot of PhD folks, but we occasionally do get in folks who claim their expertise in this because they read it in a book or they tried to study it. But in reality, our traditions and our cultures are with our elders. So we always, you know, honor the elders that are working with us, and we consult with them all the time. So we always recommend that, you know, they listen to us and see what we have to say before, you know, working with us. And we always encourage them to at least experience some of the things that we offer. I mean, we do what we call sheep hikes, trailing of the sheep sometimes. We just recently did that a month ago. Our board president hosted a sheep walk up the mountain, and I thought it was just a sheep walk, but it was actually a strenuous hike along a canyon that had the trickling river along the entire way. So the sheep, he has at least 400 heads of sheep and goats. So the sheep knew where to go, and they seasonally do this every year. They go up in the early summer and come down in the fall. So along the way, he was educating us about the mountain medicinal plants. So we got more than just a hike out of it. We had a traditional plant walk out of it. So we were harvesting tobacco along the way, or there was some sage there, or there was other wild herbs that grow up there and root systems that, you know, that you only can find in the mountain areas. So whoever was able to experience that walk got to see the traditional pastoral life way that our Navajo people have been doing for centuries. So that answers my question.
Your question. I guess it's kind of I just want to add a comment into kind of what we're doing right now. I'm on the Slow Food Board. I'm on the Seattle chapter. Something that we're really concerned about is the education and recruitment of young people into food and gardening and farming. Angela mentioned that sometimes young Latinos, Asians, Native Americans may be reluctant, and African Americans may be reluctant to come into farming given the history that they experienced. So something that one perspective we work on, it's actually sprung out from our children's school garden program, is to look at how do we broaden that and make it more inclusive to look at the next generation. And we've been partnering with the University of Washington and with Seattle Tilth, which is really kind of the gardening expert in the area, and put in a proposal to the National Science Foundation to teach garden education. We started that process about 4 years ago, didn't pass the first go around, and a month ago, it just got accepted. We got this grant for nearly $3 million to put garden education into national science standard to be adopted. And what made this particular science standard different from all the other proposals is a garden education with a cultural perspective. It's a look at how do we teach garden education that we can talk about the Three Sisters, that we can talk about the Macau Zet potato in the Pacific Northwest. How do we get children to grow bok choy instead of just growing kale? You know, and then right away that it broadens the understanding of the culture of food, and it also empowers children of color to understand their food history and acknowledge their, you know, cultural background. And again, this is literally just got accepted just a month ago. We're going to start piloting in 3 schools in the Seattle area and just slowly roll out. But ultimately, the goal is that this is going to be applied to the national standard for the Science Foundation. And it's really exciting. It's a roundabout way, but it's really important because one thing that we recognize is that it's really hard to convince the next generation of people to come into farming. And I think it's just recognizing that, empowering them and recognizing them. So part of that is that, you know, it's just still literally from the ground up. And I, you know, it's one of the effort that Slow Food is doing, but I welcome input from you all. I'm not the garden expert, but I'm trying to work with these educators from a cultural perspective and trying to work in the arc of taste and say why these food has history and meaning. So thank you.
I just had a question back to him, but really, you know, the whole thing about nutrient densities and what have you with regard to your soils and the building of your soils and what is within your narrative there to the National Science Foundation, what was the narrative kind of in relation to that? Because, I mean, for example, I mean, and that's really important because people do need to know what their food is and the nutritional contents. I mean, you may have organic and what have you, but that doesn't tell you the nutritional content of your food. And so, you know, what about that? I mean, how, you know, if we're talking about, you know, feeding youth, children in schools and what have you, the whole nutritional question and what have you with relation to that. I mean, what is the difference in the type of farming approaches that are being proposed there and what have you?
What I want to do is close out this session and just feel free to come up and ask questions, things like that. So we're closing out, and I hope that you all will all go home and go to your screen printing company and have them make a T-shirt that asks this question on the back. And wear it, because, of course, we're not experts, but we have been blessed, haven't we, to have Angela, Aretta, Rudy, and Kai. Give them a hand once again.